4 with Gart Westerhout on 22nd November 73.
This was with Bernie Burke and two. They started in the winter of 62 already. And one thing I did was get a lot of line profiles along the galactic plane, and in particular in the Perseus region. And that's the work that Jim Rickard
got involved in,
then reduced and got his master's thesis on.
I see.
That was a terrible headache because it was all on punch tape and all sorts of errors in it, and a lot of just chart recorders in the typical DTM fashion. And I think I then slowly but surely got involved in the survey. And I, of course, got very much involved in the initial stages and the debugging of the autocorrelator.
Mm-hmm. The 100 channel, yeah.
The 100 channel autocorrelator, the first one. And in fact, the initial tapes from that autocorrelator, in the first few months, the tapes went to Maryland because there was no computer at NRAO. There was a correlator and a tape recorder, but no computer.
I see.
That was a 1620 desk sort of computer.
Yeah.
Which, however, of course, couldn't read tapes.
Yeah.
So Challoway rigged up something that connected it in that could read it bit by bit. But in essence, we checked there was very initial tapes to find out was there anything on it. I think I told you that story before. He had a little box with iron filings.
Yeah.
You could then through a magnifying right. glass see the actual bits on the tape. Something else. And then a few months later, this was in 64. That was in the summer of 64. And a few months later, they got there. 74.
That was the first summer you spent out there.
No, I spent the summer of 63 there. Oh,
I see.
Again, with Burke's equipment.
Hmm.
The first winter of 62, we didn't do too much. I mean, it was more trying things out and so on. But then that summer, we spent several months getting 21 centimeter line profiles with the DTM receiver.
But you didn't publish any of this.
I didn't publish
any. No. In fact, really none of this has been published in journals.
No, there was some of it in symposia reports,
yeah.
By Burke, and some of it, of course, in the Carnegie Institution stuff. Well, what of Carnegie has been published in journals?
Yeah, that's
very
true.
Very little.
Yeah.
Very little.
But I was just thinking, even of all of your hydrogen work, none of it's been published in journals.
No.
You've had the two editions of the survey, and now the third one.
Yeah, quite great. Yeah, I've more or less stopped publishing extensive papers since I came to Maryland. That's quite correct. I hope that now that I'm off administrative duties, that I'll be able to
yeah.
correct that. Even though I have quite a list of papers after I did come to Maryland, most of those are either review papers or papers with other people or what have you.
Yeah. Well, what was the motivation behind the large survey? I mean, one can think of a couple obvious things, but was it the sort of the next step from Kotvik to Dwingelow? I mean, from Kotvik 1 to Kotvik 2, and now this would be the one that...
Yes. The Dwingelow... In Dwingelow, they never got around to making a complete survey. So I decided, let's skip that step and do it immediately with a large telescope. And I know this is going to take a number of years, but... So what? So it'll take a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, took longer than I expected. But, in other words, use the telescope with the highest resolution
as
wide a region of the galaxy as possible.
And of course,
it's quite clear that we have to get down to the details now.
And of course, it's quite suitable for a survey instrument, also.
Right. Yeah. So that the main motivation was, as you have noticed for most of my papers, I mean, they're all survey papers. I'm that way motivated.
Right.
I'd like to produce something that is useful more than once.
Yeah.
Not just to me, but to a lot of people.
Yeah.
I've been doing that in essence and a whole lot of my research. And yeah. I wanted to do that specifically with that, and I defended the survey specifically on that basis.
Hmm.
Service to the community, we need it. I'm interested in the galaxy myself, quite obviously, but there is such a wealth of material that you should get it at it in a systematic way. You'll never get it.
I just thought of one question that Metzger commented on a little bit this morning, namely the early days of NREO. There was various friction between the universities and NREO, the former thinking the latter wasn't worth too much. And, now you were a university user of it in the early days. Were you not agreeing with these people?
Of course, I was very strongly in disagreement with those people because I felt NREO. Don't forget that I, of course, came from a university where there was a national facility that could be used by that university and anybody else. Yeah. So I was already aware of the advantages of that sort of a setup. And of course, in Maryland. Well, right from the start, I felt that if you want large telescopes, you should do it nationally and not spread the interest all that widely. So I was very, very... Now, it was indeed true that initially, because of some bungling with the 144th and so on, things didn't go as rapidly as perhaps they should have at NREO. But even initially, NREO did quite a bit of pioneering work. Some of it didn't quite come off well, but...
Well, there was a period, though. I mean, the first couple of years after the Tatel telescope, yes, but wasn't there a period from sort of 60 to 64 where there wasn't a whole lot coming out of NREO?
Yeah, I was going to say, the first years of the Tatel telescope, there were quite a bit coming out at that point. Then, of course, came 300 foot, when it was clear that the 140 foot would take much longer than... Yeah. In fact, the Tatel telescope was built as an afterthought.
Oh, sorry, the 140 foot was going to be the first one.
It was going to be the first one. Yeah. Then they decided, let's put a small one up too. Thank goodness they decided that.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the 300 foot was built out of surplus funds, more or less.
Yeah, it was...
Not quite, of course. I mean, they had to have permission and all that.
But that was very successful, especially when you...
Unbelievable masterpiece, that telescope.
Especially when you look at the cost of it. Yeah.
Right. Well, only the cost, but everything that could be done with it. The thing that was wrong with it was not the telescope, but the damn astronomers. Not only at NREO, but in particular the damn astronomers everywhere else, who said, I don't want to use that telescope, because it's a transit telescope and I want to be able to follow a source.
Yeah.
The things that could have been done with that telescope that weren't done because people just were too lazy.
Too lazy to add up different days' data, essentially.
Unbelievable. I have never understood that and I still don't.
Okay. Well, shall we go back to the trip around the world? I'd be interested in your comments about what was going on then. Or what the different...
During that trip, of course, I also visited NREO, and in fact that was the second outside user of NREO. George Field was the first.
I've seen your thing on the 8,000 megahertz survey, or you have a little write-up, I think for IRSI or something, describing whether it would be feasible to do a survey with the Tatel telescope, a continuum survey.
I do?
Yeah. I found that somewhere. I can't remember where. I think it was 8 gigahertz sticks in my mind.
Yeah, right. That's what I was going to do.
Yeah.
I was going to make an 8 gigahertz survey.
This describes the feasibility of it. And I thought your conclusion was that there were some problems in doing it.
Yes, quite. I went to... This was in 59. But I don't remember having...
This may be just an internal report.
That's what you may have seen. I wrote at the end of that period, I cut my stay at NREO short. And at the end of that period, I wrote an internal report. I rediscovered the fact that the sky at 3 centimeters radiates by... that was a rather interesting thing. I concluded that given the large bandwidth of the traveling wave tube receiver that they had and so on, I could do it. Make a survey. Of course, and I was again interested in continuum survey, this time at 3 centimeters with a much higher resolution.
Right.
And looking at really the thermal radiation only. I mean, it was all beautifully, completely workable.
Yeah.
In fact, I'd still like to do it sometime. But the one snag that neither I nor any of the people at NRAO realized was the radiation of the sky, the variable radiation of the sky.
From the atmosphere.
From the atmosphere. Yeah. And that could indeed be as serious as it was.
Yeah.
And this was very funny because this receiver was provided by you and Knight, and we blamed the thing on the receiver. So John Campbell from you and Knight would come over and spend days trying to fix the instabilities on the receiver, and then it would go nice and smooth for a little while, and then everything would go all over the scale again. This was when full scale was 2 degrees or something like that.
Yeah.
And I got absolutely, I made quite a number, I spent a number of nights making scans across the galaxy, and in the end found out what it was by going through the old MIT series, the wartime, right. After the war,
radiation, MIT, lab, yeah.
Radiation lab series, and calculating all the various effects, and I then wrote an internal report and left.
I guess they must have known this at NRL, I mean.
Yeah.
But it just wasn't known at NRAO. Yeah.
None of the people at NRAO, neither did I.
Yeah. What about, you said George Field was the first user. I didn't know he'd done any observational radio astronomy.
Yeah, what was he doing there at 3 centimeters? I'm trying to think what he was doing there at 3 centimeters. No, he wasn't doing anything at 3 centimeters. They had a 21 centimeter receiver, and he was trying to look for intergalactic hydrogen.
Oh, yes, there is a paper. Yeah.
He was trying to look for intergalactic hydrogen.
That's right. That's was he at Berkeley then?
No. He was at that time, I think he was at Princeton. He was at Harvard before then.
Oh, he got his degree at Harvard.
I think he did, yeah.
I see, so he's going full circle now.
That was a very nice time there. At NRAO, because everything was sort of still rather primitive, although they had beautiful equipment, things were sort of primitive. And me, with my enthusiasm, always wanted things better and more automated. For example, Bill Meredith still remembers he was one of the telescope operators at that time, and of course Fred Cruz can tell you that story too about my digital recording mechanism. There was in the corner one of those Hewlett Packard printers, which printed out numbers, just intensities, but nothing else. So I decided that I wanted positions on there as well. And there was no proper way to get positions on there. The only way I could see to get positions on there was every degree to move the paper one step.
Oh, yeah.
That wasn't possible either. The only way you could move the paper was pulling this little handle. So I made a string running all the way across the ceiling to the operator's table, and every time he passed a degree, he pulled the string and the paper went one thing further.
This sounds familiar. It sounds like the setup that you had for your occultation.
Yeah, right. I think I was referring to that earlier when I was talking about the occultation. Yeah. Beeswax and...
Ceiling wax and...
No.
What was the expression?
Beeswax. No. String and beeswax or something.
String and ceiling wax, I think.
String and... But what is ceiling wax?
To seal something. You know.
Oh, that's sort of ceiling wax. Yeah. Not to see. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
So that was the situation in NRAO.
Right.
Where else did you visit?
I started out at Ann Arbor, and in essence that the whole trip was more or less just inspecting. Looking around, seeing what everybody was doing. Started out in Ann Arbor, and I went to Columbus, Ohio, and saw...
Well, hold it. What was? Can you just tell me very briefly just what was going on? In Ann Arbor, do they have the 85-foot?
In Ann Arbor, they had the 85-foot. No. The 85-foot was just being finished. It was slightly behind the one at NRAO. And they had their 20-foot or whatever it was, and they were doing solar patrol, and that was about it.
That was Haddock.
That was Haddock. Yeah. And Howard was there at the time.
And then Ohio State?
Then I went to Ohio State and saw Krauss's
helical
array with 96 helices. That was a neat instrument.
Yeah.
And I went to Toronto where I saw McRae, who had some horn antenna set up to do a absolute flux measurement experiment. And then I went to Harvard, where of course I saw MC Bock. At that time, of course, was already in Australia, had been for quite a while. Tommy Gold was there, in charge of the place.
He was in charge of the Agassiz station?
Of the Agassiz station, but about to go to
Cornell.
About to go to Cornell and trying hard to convince me to take it over. But I didn't have any. So I saw the Agassiz station set up, and I was very unimpressed by the general ineptitude of everybody. I had the feeling that they got absolutely nowhere. They had all sorts of equipment, but they weren't doing much. I mean, as compared to what they were doing in Holland.
Yeah.
I found Harvard, and I must say,
it's funny though, a number of good people have come out of that. The work they did at that time, I have to agree with you, is not very interesting. No. And in fact, a couple of the things are just plain wrong, of course.
But yet, a number of good people came out of it, so you never can tell. And of course, I went to I visited NRL quite extensively.
What was your impression there?
I was very impressed with NRL. I mean, there was an enormous amount going on. I mean, all the way to the very high frequencies. I was sort of disgusted and told them so, that they didn't make more use of their big dish.
Which one, the 84 foot?
The 50 foot. The one on the roof.
Yeah, by then it was switching over to radar.
Mm-hmm. And I absolutely flabbergasted, what's his name, Ed McLean, who was then head of the section, by asking him when the 600 foot telescope was going to be ready. And he went,
I mean, that was something. Said,
what 600 foot? I said, the 600 foot telescope that you're all building in West Virginia. Mm-hmm. Then he finally had to come up with this. He says, how do you know?
Was it supposed to be secret?
Then? Yeah, at that time that was highly classified. But we all knew about it in Holland somehow or another. Well, I got the first.
This was 58, wasn't it?
59, yeah.
59, this is 59. Funny, yeah, very early. Yeah.
We all knew about it in Holland.
This was before any of the real troubles began with it.
Yeah, quite. So I got absolutely nothing out of him, obviously, because of his classified subject, but I can still see him absolutely reeling back at this idiotic Dutchman knew.
Yeah.
For all you know, he may have thought that I was a spy from the CIA or something.
That's why they made you have to have an escort around the laboratory. You may remember that as a foreigner, you had to have an escort.
Oh yes, well that's still so.
Right.
It's always the case. But so NRL, I was quite. In fact, I think I visited NRL twice. I came back later from NRAO to visit them once more. I was very those were the days too. That's here's a maybe not an anecdote, but a real historical thing. I don't think you've ever seen it that way. The DTM, Broad Branch Road, Washington, East Northwest. They had this Wurzburg sitting in the backyard. From the Wurzburg went a little cable into the lab. The lab was in the room next to the director's office, which was Merle too. The lab was an absolute mess. Wires coming in here, wires flying from here to there. Unbelievable mess. But somewhere in the middle was the recorder with a little table in front of it.
Yeah.
And there were recording charts all over. And so I came in and I was ushered into Tu's office, and we talked for about 5 minutes. And Tu said, We're wasting our time. Let's take some data while we're talking. So we walked next door in the lab, and he switched on the laser and said, where shall we point it today? So we decided to point it. I wanted to see the famous L equals 50, B equals 0, our standard field. So we pointed it to L equals 50, B equals 0. That took quite a bit of doing. And there it came. Well, isn't that marvelous? Look at those peaks. Now let's look at something else. So we looked at something else. And that was the way line profiles were recorded at the DTF. Well, that was most remarkable.
But, I'm sorry, this is the same one that was shown the Queen? The same field? I thought you said 150.
No, L equals 50. The same, yeah.
I thought earlier, though, that you said 150.
No.
It's 50.
L is 50, B is 0. Okay. It's in the neighborhood of longitude 90.
Yeah.
New longitude 90. Right.
Okay.
Just the line. You find it.
I just wanted to check
that. Just the line and standard field, of course. It's a rotten field for standard field, but I don't know how I got to use it anyway. It's one of the classical profiles that goes with three beautiful humps and a little force hump at the end.
Yeah. Okay, so...
So that was the DTM. On the one hand, I was impressed by the way in which something came out of all those wires. On the other hand, I was somewhat amazed that they had such good equipment there and did nothing with it.
Yeah.
And I saw that Mills Cross out on River Road.
Yeah.
And let me see, and then I think I went to NRAO and stayed there for a number of weeks. Let me see what other places did I visit on the East Coast. I think that was about it, or Princeton and things like that, but there isn't much to say about it. I was thinking, I went to an AAS meeting in Rochester. And then I went to Caltech, and I spent about 2 months in Caltech. Instead of spending the 2 months at NRAO, I then spent the 2 months in Caltech. And I don't quite know what I did, except talk with people. I did a lot of talking to people. I didn't make any observations as such.
So what did they have there then?
They had the new interferometer was just ready.
This was 59?
59.
It was right. Okay, just starting, yeah?
Yeah, it was just starting up. That was, of course, a very exciting time because everything was humming and buzzing interest.
What about the optical astronomers there? Were they sort of aloof from all this radio stuff then? Or?
Yes, I was, and I have always been, invariably, even now, whenever I visit Caltech, I am always disgusted at the way the optical astronomers don't really know what's going on and no contact with the radio astronomy group, even though it's in the same building and everything.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Even with
Schmidt. And then include Schmidt.
Yeah. That's surprising.
Very surprising.
And even with Greenstein having contributed quite a bit to the early theory of in the radio.
Yeah. But they were sort of benevolently looking on. It was a good source of money. It was plenty endowed by the Navy or whatever.
Yeah. Right.
I think that was, we didn't see too much in it.
But scientifically, it really wasn't so worthwhile.
I've always found that amazing. That, of course, has been the downfall of the Owens Valley Radio, the array that they wanted to build. The lack of interest.
From the optical?
The lack of interest of Caltech itself. The radio astronomers were enthusiastic, but the school wasn't interested.
I see. No, I didn't realize that. You mean for the full array?
When there was this competition between the VLA and the Owens Valley Array.
Right.
Before the Dickey Committee.
And several other things. Yeah.
And then of course the various big dishes as well.
Right.
But I think that was the down to that non-interest from the optical astronomers was the downfall of that. Because basically they could. And the other thing that I'm always blaming them for is that they did not latch on immediately to Ryle's super synthesis idea. They had all the equipment, except that they didn't have a phase stable system, even though the phase stable system had already been made and proven and was in full operation at Stanford several years before, mm-hmm. as developed by Svarup. They didn't bother about the phase stable system. They were working all the time on, this was now I'm not talking about 62. Right. When Ryle came
and
out.
They worked with just source
they
models.
Had two editions. They just had amplitude spacing diagrams and then fitted crude models to it.
Right.
And they could have, within half a year, they could have completely wiped out the field.
Yeah.
And when did they finally have a phase stable system started doing aperture synthesis? I don't know.
65?
Years and years. 65. No, much later.
Later than that, 68.
Long after Ryle had come out with all these beautiful maps that they properly started.
Yeah, you're right. That's right. It is later than that, yeah.
That really, I would say, sets...
Well, Kurt Weiler's stuff, I think, was amongst the earliest of it. Yeah, and the crab and all.
Yeah, right. That, I think, really set radio astronomy in the United States back quite a bit. The fact that people, in general, did not catch on to new ideas. They stuck to their own old ways.
Well, do you have some other examples of that, or...? Of course, there's the whole fact that it wasn't developed at all after the war, whereas in England and Australia and in Holland it was.
Yeah, but it got this enormous kick in the pants in the late 50s.
Right.
And yet, but somehow or another, it didn't develop, and the main reason there is that there was no astronomer interest. The only astronomer who was interested, in a way, was Bok, and he left.
But that wasn't really what made it go... Well, in Holland you have Oort, of course, but in England it certainly wasn't classical astronomer interest that made...
No, it wasn't classical astronomer interest, but the people who were doing it were physicists who were interested in getting results
So you mean interest
they
from
were
scientists
technicians.
Rather than engineers?
Yeah, right. Okay, it's engineers. Sorry, I didn't mean to use the word technicians. Engineers, right. It was engineers in almost every place. And those, in collaboration with the astronomers, could have done a lot.
Yeah.
But somehow or other, the astronomers never got to it. Because Vitti's hole in the ground is a funny example of that. I mean, Swenson is a marvelous engineer. The hole in the ground was built. It had its troubles, but somehow or another, Dick Vitti wasn't the man to run it. And when support faltered, no, not when support faltered, he felt that the Navy had given him an assignment. And it's little to do with the university. And he never got any university people involved.
Yes, sir.
So eventually the thing fizzled out.
Did you visit Stanford?
Yes, I visited Stanford.
What was going on?
I visited Berkeley.
What was going on?
Did I visit Berkeley? Yeah, of course I visited Berkeley, but I'm trying to think what was going on in Berkeley. I didn't go to Hat Creek because Hat Creek didn't exist yet. They were building Hat Creek. Yeah, they were building Hat Creek. At Stanford, of course, there was Bracewell's beautiful solar cross, which was going full tilt. That was a marvelous piece of machinery.
Who else was at Stanford beside Bracewell? You said Svarup.
Svarup was at Stanford at the time, and I think there must have been a few more people, but I can't think of any names. Thompson came later. Thompson was still in England at the time. He didn't come that much later. He came in the early 60s. Very early 60s.
Well, what about, I guess that covers the U.S.
Yeah, and I'm from Australia, and of course,
impressions there.
Very impressed by CSIRO. This was where they were just beginning to lay the sticking the first spades in the ground for Parkes. everybody was still at CSIRO, am I right? 59?
Yeah, they didn't start leaving really until
60, 61, yeah. Right. But you could feel the friction already.
Yeah.
That stage. I mean, they were completely separate groups. Who would hardly talk to each other.
Yeah.
But the thing that impressed me most at CSIRO was the unbelievable support staff. I mean, the huge workshops.
Mm-hmm.
That's what made CSIRO what it is. That they have this enormous amount of manpower and availability of workshop time. I mean, Paul Wilde's machine, his circle, every single antenna was built in the workshop.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, nothing was contracted out. The same as Christiansen's array.
But this was
still in use.
But this was true in the late 50s also. That,
yeah. Oh yeah, they had an enormous workshop.
Were most of their early antennas, all their early dishes, all built?
All homemade. All homemade.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Well, all single homemade.
So, where else did you go? I guess all that's left is England and maybe France.
No, this was part of, I mean, England and France I went to. Oh, there's another section. This is, I think this covers this particular trip around the world.
Yeah.
There's another section after that, and somewhat before that, where you may be interested in hearing some of my comments, and that is the Benelux Cross.
Yeah.
So this is an entirely different subject. Okay. You may write the number where we start on the Benelux Cross there, because
right.
I was involved in that, of course, from the very beginning, which I think was 57, when Charles Seeger suggested a million dipoles in the form of a cross at 400 megahertz. And I sincerely think that man was an idealist, and when he had an ideal and was enthusiastic for something, he would not stop talking about it and come up with more ideas and more suggestions and more things you could do with it. And he kept talking to Oort, and I think he talked Oort into it. I think the fact that there is Westerbork now is initially due to the enthusiasm of Seeger for mm-hmm. building something really big.
Yeah.
He would never bring it off, but he would certainly initiate the thoughts. The million dipoles, of course, already shows how completely unrealistic it was. But the idea of having something...
He had the vision.
Something going and something big. And then Oort somehow or another got on, of course, to making it the Benelux project. Or maybe it wasn't Oort, maybe it was Banier and ZWO who thought that might be a good trick. It, of course, then became quite a design study of cylindrical paraboloids. At that point, Bologna froze it because they, at that point, had money and built the cylindrical paraboloids, more or less precisely the Leiden design.
Yeah. Yeah, Christiansen went down there and advised them for a few months.
Mm-hmm. That was still for 400 megahertz, and that was many kilometers long. I still remember making a picture of it on a map of Leiden.
Show how long it was. Yeah.
Showing how big it was. It was hanging on the wall for a long time there in Sterla. And then it finally became 25 meter dishes in the form of a cross. And that was the point where we said, now we're almost there. That was the point where we were seriously negotiating with the Belgians about who was going to give what and where it was going. And I was then in charge of site survey. And boy, did I travel around And the funny thing is that people kept saying, later on in particular, people always say, well, of course it had to be built on the border of Holland and Belgium,
right,
because it was a Benelux instrument. That was not the original reason at all. It so turned out that that was, among all the various regions concerned, one of the thinnest populated regions. All border regions in general are thinly populated, because the towns are either off in that direction or off in that direction, with only one or two main roads in between. The Belgians,
why
or
is
the
it,
Germans.
Why are the towns
people
that way?
Don't cross borders. Right?
So you can't have a town right...
So you can't have a town right on one side of the border. So the border area in general, in many areas, has the towns rather far removed from each other. And no main roads. Little roads that gradually grow bigger as they get closer to the towns. But the roads are littlest right around the border area. So looking at the maps and then population densities and industries and so on, those general areas in between Holland and Belgium were extremely useful. Other areas that were useful were, of course, up north and the Zuiderzee.
Yeah. You mean the Polderland was considered?
Yeah, we went and made a big expedition there with the heads of the Zuiderzee Werk and designed the thing right along a dike. In fact, we could still have had the dike slightly changed before it was actually dredged out, had we made the decision within the next 3 months then. So we were still at the position where they could have arranged things according to our pleasure. But engineers went into studies of how stable the stuff would be, how fast it would sag, and it turned out that it was remarkably slow. Remarkably little after the initial settling of the soil. You did not have to worry too much about the telescope sort of slowly but surely sagging as the soil settled further. Apparently it's the initial year where everything more or less settled after the water has been pumped out.
And it's stabilized.
Very little more happens.
So your recommendation turned out to have political advantages, but that wasn't the reason.
Yeah, it wasn't the reason, no. Well, we traveled back and forth around that border with usually accompanied by a special customs officer or something like that. Because at the same time, of course, we didn't want to give it too much fanfare.
Yeah, publicity, yeah.
Publicity at all. And we found a most marvelous site. That was, in fact, the site we had more or less decided on in the end. When we found out that in the big future plan, European Route E3 or something like that was going to go right through there. We still decided for that area because we then figured out that we could shield E3. I then went to the Dutch railways. And you say, why the Dutch railways? The Dutch railways were very good at putting up masts and posts and things like that. So I had them calculate how much it would cost to put up concrete or what have you, or metal masts all the way across a railroad track over such and such a length, and then cover them with wire.
Yeah.
In other words, put the whole E3 in a Faraday cage.
Right.
It was rather expensive. It was a million guilders or a few million guilders or something like that. It also turned out, so that was one possibility. The other possibility, which was very much cheaper, which came to about a million guilders, was make a dike on the appropriate side of that road.
A bank.
Well, everything that goes like that,
it's a dike.
It's called a dike. I think the bank was going to be 5 or 6 meters high, and then on top of it we're going to put a 5 meter metal fence. And believe it or not, the calculation showed that that cut the radio noise from cars on driving on that road down by, I seem to remember, it was 64 dB or something like that. Unbelievable! Just that expediency of going up 10 meters.
This is what they're going to end up doing for the Cambridge, the 5 kilometer with the expressway. Yeah.
Is there an expressway coming by there?
Yeah. But they're going to have a big mound and a big fence.
Yeah.
Just the same sort of thing you're describing. That was the compromise.
Yeah, so I was rather involved in that thing until, more or less until the time, yeah. Yeah, in December of 61 we had this OECD symposium in Paris, which I'm sure you have the proceedings of. I gave two papers there, one on the site survey and one of the sensitivity limits of an unfilled aperture. There's all the various quantities involved.
But you never got into interferometry, you?
No, I personally never got into interferometry, no. I wanted to get into interferometry, at line interferometry at NRAO. But somehow or another NRAO decided that they wanted to make that an in-house effort. So I never got into that. That was a pity. I certainly would have liked to. And of course I was at that stage already getting too involved in all the various administration problems in Maryland that I could really simply say, well, never mind whether you like it or not, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
Because what is Heinz there, I think we would have been able to get at it much more quickly than they actually did it in Ireland.
Yeah, and of course it's still not really figured out.
Still not really figured out.
Well, I think that covers an awful lot. Mm-hmm. Unless you can think of some other things that you'd like to put on the record. Thank you very much. And it ends an interview with Garth Westerhout on 22nd November 1973.